The title of this session is The Constitution, How Long Will It Last? Other than the Bible, I believe that the United States Constitution is the single most important document that's ever been written. And the reason I say that is the United States Constitution has given more people more economic and political freedom than any other document on the face of the earth. And how many of you know that something is wrong with our Constitution? It's in a crisis. It is very common to receive Supreme Court rulings that have no basis in the Constitution at all. I don't know if you followed the latest case early summer, that was handed down, Obergefell v. Hodges. That's the case that pulled out of thin air a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. This is what Justice Roberts said in his dissenting opinion. He said, if you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means, celebrate today's decision. But then he goes on and he says, but do not celebrate the Constitution, for it had nothing to do with it. And this is the sort of place that we find ourselves in. Courts keep making decisions that have nothing to do with the actual text of the Constitution. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals a few years back said that the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. And on we could go with various examples. A lot of people think this is a recent problem. But what I'd like to show you is this seed, bad seed, went into the ground a long time ago. And what we're seeing today is just sort of the ripened fruits of it. And it's hard to come up with a cure to something unless you diagnose the problem accurately. So what I would like to do in this presentation is sort of diagnose the problem for you and explain to you how things came to be the way we have them today. And once we understand that, we'll have a better grasp on what we should do in response. So here's the outline of this presentation. We're going to look at, number one, the Founding Fathers' original vision for the Constitution and the judicial branch of government. Number two, I'll sort of explain to you the changes that happened and why they came about, which helps us understand why things are the way they are now. And then number three, I'll take a little look at the impact that this issue has had on society. Number four, I'll take a look at some illustrations. And then finally, number five, I'll sort of show you the future. It's not a very good one either. Unless this trend changes, I'll show you exactly where the future is headed. So let's talk about the original vision of the Founding Fathers for the judicial branch of government. What was the design of our Founding Fathers when they set up the judicial branch of government? Well, our Founding Fathers simply wanted the judges and justices, when they were adjudicating matters before them, to take the original intent of the Constitution and apply it to the facts that were before them. So they were never to create law, they were to discover intent and apply it. Thomas Jefferson describes judicial philosophy this way to judges: carry ourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted, recollect the spirit in the debates, and instead of trying to find what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was passed. Here is a quote from Chief Justice John Marshall, our third Chief Justice to the United States Supreme Court. He writes in an opinion To say that the intention of the instrument must prevail, that this intention must be collected from its words, that its words are to be understood in the sense in which they were generally used by those whom the instrument was intended, that its provisions are neither to be restricted into insignificance nor extended into objects not comprehended in them nor contemplated by its framers, is to repeat what has already been said more and large, and all that is necessary. The founding fathers simply wanted judges to take the original intent of the Constitution as the framers understood it and apply it. Pretty simple. Well, you might ask yourself, well, that's a pretty simplistic formula. We're living now in the 21st century. The Constitution came about in the 18th century. What if you have to change the Constitution to keep up with changing times? And the answer is the Constitution itself gives the mechanism by which the Constitution is to be changed. It's called Article 5 in the Constitution, and it's the amendment process. Changing the Constitution is placed in the hands of the people's representatives. And that way, if I, as a voter, don't like the way they're changing the document, I can vote against them, can I, in the next election? So George Washington puts it this way. He says, if in the opinion of the distribution or modification of constitutional powers be it any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment the way the Constitution designates, but let there be no change by usurpation. Though that may be in the one instance for good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. If the judges, George Washington said, ever get into the business of rewriting the Constitution, they might do some good here and there. But with the power to do good is the power to do evil. And so George Washington, I think George Washington might know something about the Constitution, right? Being our first president. The Constitution is to be changed by the amendment process. And that was the original vision of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, therefore, is called in Federalist Paper number 78. And remember, the Federalist Papers were written to convince the citizens of New York to ratify the Constitution. So the Federalist Papers are a tremendous source of light to us in terms of the Constitution's original intent. Federalist Paper number 78 calls the judicial branch of government the least dangerous branch. David Barton, a historian, says this, as in many documents, the Constitution lists the most important aspects first, pressing on to those of lesser consequence. Following the preamble, Article 1 describes Congress, Article 2, the presidency, Article 3, the judiciary. Not only does the order of their listing of their relative importance, but the amount of detail provided by each branch also reflects its relative importance. The legislature, Article 1, received 255 lines of print, while the presidency, Article 2, only 114 lines, and the judiciary, Article 3, only 44 lines. So the judicial branch of government is the least dangerous branch of government, not only in terms of the order in which the judicial branch of government is listed compared to the other branches, but the amount of detail is less in comparison to the detail our founding fathers gave to the presidency and the legislative branch of government. They never envisioned a huge role for the Supreme Court. It was intended to be a very impotent branch of government. In fact, John Jay, who was our first Chief Justice to the United States Supreme Court, when George Washington wanted to reappoint John Jay to that position, John Jay turned the job down because he thought it was a dead-end job. He would be stuck in some position where he'd have no influence. Most people don't know this, but the United States Supreme Court didn't even have its own building until 1935, meeting in the basement of the Senate. And most people don't know this either. The United States Supreme Court never met on a full-time basis until the Eisenhower administration. So you have to sort of understand this history to understand the monumental changes that happened that I'm about to explain. So let's move on into some evolutionary changes. But the changes really began to develop around the year 1870. And let me give you three names, if I could. Number one, Columbus Langdale, who was the dean at Harvard Law School. Number two, Roscoe Pound, who was Langdale's successor at Harvard Law School. And number three, a third name you should know, is Oliver Wendell Holmes. Oliver Wendell Holmes took the principles that he learned at Harvard Law School and went on to a Supreme Court career of about 30 years. Here is a quote typically ascribed to Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln said this: "The philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next." So what happened is they began to introduce changes, if you will, in the law schools. You can affect negatively vast, vast groups of people. And they began to introduce a brand new system of constitutional law called legal positivism. Legal positivism is the idea that the function of a judge is no longer to study the original intent of our founding fathers. What they are instead to study is society. They're to study the changing needs, wants, and desires of society, and the function of a judge, therefore, is to reinterpret the Constitution to keep up with a changing society. Now, what precipitated these changes? These changes were introduced in academia about 1870. Does anybody know what was published in 1859, 11 years earlier? Darwin's Origin of the Species. And what we have to understand about Darwinism is it's a lot more to it than just a biology. It brings with it an anthropology, which is a doctrine of man. And what, in essence, Darwinism teaches is that man is evolving upward. You know, he went from the goo to the zoo to you. And the evolutionary process has not stopped. Man continues to evolve upward. He is in this upward ascent, see. And since the scientific world bought into that idea, the legal philosophers said to themselves, well, if that's true, then we need a constitution that evolves with man. So we can no longer be locked into 18th century principles. And so this opened the door to this idea that the Constitution must change with the times, and it's to be changed not through the amendment process, Article 5, but rather it's to be changed by the judges. And consequently, the Constitution became known as a living, breathing document. Have you heard that before? People say that all of the time. What that means is the Constitution has a meaning independent of its original authors, which means that the Constitution has within it no fixed principles. The function of a judge is just to simply massage it, the language, from one generation to the next to keep up with this upward ascent of man. Now, this radically shifted the function of a jurist or a judge. A judge no longer studies the founding fathers and applies it to their text or their case before them, but rather they're enmeshed in society, trying to figure out the next quantum leap in evolution and to reinterpret the document to keep up. This really should come as no surprise. Evolution is not just a biological theory, it's a theory of government. And various anti-God systems, like communism, which we just heard about, Nazism, racism, are all built on an evolutionary foundation. In fact, one of the individuals that Karl Marx devoted his volume to, Das Kapital, was to Charles Darwin. Because all Marx did is took Darwin's thoughts and built on top of it a little bit and built a philosophy of government. And that's what these legal positivists began to do in the law schools. Now, people say, well, you know, I just don't believe that this is true. And let me give you a few quotes. This is a quote from Fred Cahill, political scientist, and he writes this. The appearance in the mid-19th century of the concept of evolution was an event of transcending importance to the development of American jurisprudence. This involved a shift from the rational, deductive pattern characteristic of the pre-Darwinian period to the empirical, evolutionary approach that is followed today. And what he's saying is evolution is at the heart of our judicial system in terms of a philosophy of interpretation. Here is a quote from Justice Brennan, who was a longtime member of the United States Supreme Court. In a 1985 address to the American Bar Association, Justice William Brennan contended that this evolutionary process is inevitable and is the interpretive genius of the text. And what he's basically saying there is the Constitution was designed to be deliberately vague by our founding fathers, so a judge could massage the language one direction or the next, depending on their view of this upward trajectory of society. Lawrence Tribe, who's a very well-known constitutional attorney and law professor, says the Constitution is an intentionally incomplete and often deliberately indeterminate structure for the participatory evolution of political ideas and government practices. Lawrence Tribe goes on and he says, the highest mission of the Supreme Court, in my view, is not to conserve judicial credibility. I think the court's done a good job with that, by the way. But in the Constitution's own phrase, to form a more perfect union between right and rights within that charter's necessarily evolutionary design. Now, here's a problem with their view. If the theory of evolution didn't even come about until 1859, how is it that we think that our founding fathers were thinking anything about evolution back at the end of the 18th century when they put together the United States Constitution? But you see, this view is the dominant view that is taught today in law schools. Here's a quotation from an actual Supreme Court case. It talks here about the evolving standard of decency. So you see how evolution keeps showing up over and over again in these textbooks and in these Supreme Court opinions. And, you know, kind of flash back just for a minute to John Marshall and what his view was. Thomas Jefferson and what his view was. Those guys were all about what? Going back to the original intent of the Constitution and applying it to the facts before them. This new standard of interpretation is completely different. It's talking about an evolving document, you see. Underlying the disagreement over the interpretation of the Constitution is a confrontation between two worldviews. The creationist, absolutist Newtonian views of the framers versus the evolutionist relativist Darwinian views of most legal scholars today. So you see what he's saying here is essentially what you have are two camps related to how the Constitution must be interpreted. The framers he calls Newtonian, and this new school of thought he calls evolutionary. And see, this is why there's such a sharp conflict related to how this document is to be interpreted and how this document is to be understood. So now that I've kind of explained the issue, let's move on to a third major area, because you might be looking at this and your eyes might be kind of glazing over and you might be saying, you know, how does this affect my life? What I'd like to show you is I think this is probably the number one culture issue of our day, what I'm describing here. So let's talk a little bit about societal impact. But the first issue is there has been a major shift in authority in our society. Here's a quote from Ed Meese. Ed Meese says this, under the old system, the question was how to read the Constitution. Under the new approach, the question is whether to read the Constitution. See that? Here's a quote from Felix Frankfurter. He's one of the more conservatives. He says, "The ultimate touchstone of constitutionality is the Constitution itself and not what we as judges have said about it." Contrast that quote with Charles Evans Hughes, who says, "We are under a constitution, but the Constitution is what the judge says it is." So what has happened to America is we, to a very large degree, are living under what I would call a post-constitutional republic. We are not governed by the Constitution itself. We are being governed by the latest Supreme Court opinion. That's why we all sit around nervous around June and July, wondering what the Supreme Court is going to do. Why are we nervous about this? Because we don't know which way the judges are going to evolve the document. Are rights that I enjoy today going to be gone tomorrow? And so that's sort of the position that we find ourselves in. So what we have happening here is what I would call a massive shift in authority from the Constitution itself to the mind of the judge. And something else that's happening is we have greatly under attack today the death of unalienable rights. What are unalienable rights? Unalienable rights are basically rights that we have that no one can take away, because where do those rights come from? From God. Notice some language in the Declaration of Independence. The laws of nature and nature's God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are evolved equally. Oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't say that. All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. We ought to wake up every day as Americans and praise God that we live in a country where our rights come from Him. Why is that? Because if they come from God, who can take them away? Man can't. That's the whole concept of unalienable rights. But you see, with this evolving document mentality and this evolving document theory, one day those rights could be here, the next day they could disappear. And if you don't believe me, ask the opinion of about 40 million unborn children who've been aborted in this country since Roe versus Wade. One day, laws protecting the unborn are acceptable under the Constitution. The next day, with Roe versus Wade around 1972, 1973, that right disappeared. And these legal positivists are really not known for their great opinion on human rights. Here's a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes. Listen to what he says. "I see no reason for attributing to a man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand." Janet Reno, who was the Attorney General in the Clinton Justice Department, I kind of look at that as an oxymoron, Clinton Justice Department, but she was the Attorney General during that time, and she says this: "You are part of a government that has given its people more freedom than any other government in the history of the world." Is that true? It's not the government that gives us freedom, Janet. It's God that gives us freedom. The function of the United States government is not to create rights, but it recognizes rights and protects rights. But you see, one day a right could be there, the next day it could disappear. Another societal change that is happening is you have a rejection of the Founding Fathers' ideas. One of the things that our children are not being exposed to in the school system is the belief system of our Founding Fathers. John Dewey, the father of public education in America, puts it this way. He says, "The belief in political fixity of the sanctity of some form of state consecrated by the efforts of our fathers and hallowed by tradition is one of the stumbling blocks in the way of orderly and direct change." So what he's saying is, if you go back to the original intent of our founding fathers, essentially, what you're doing is you're holding people back. You're placing a stumbling block in front of them in terms of progress. Wayne Grudem, an evangelical, puts it this way: if human beings are continually evolving for the better, then the wisdom of earlier generations is not as likely to be seen as the wisdom of earlier generations is not likely to be as valuable as modern thought. So if everything is moving in this upward trajectory, if man is going from the goo to the zoo to the you, and if the Constitution must go on this upward ascent, then going back to the views of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Jay is like returning to the orangutans. And that's the paradigm that we are stuck in, and this is one of the reasons why the views of the founding fathers are very large extent being discarded today. Now, there used to be something in law schools called Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. Has anybody ever heard of those? I'm shocked. I've gone all the way through a degree in political science and a degree in law. I'd never even heard of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. But Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law used to be the commentary that lawyers and judges were steeped in. Here's a judge. He says way back in the 1700s, 18th century, for nearly 30 years, Blackstone's Commentaries has been the manual of almost every law student in the United States. And its uncommon excellence has introduced it into the libraries and often to the favorite reading of private gentlemen. In other words, everybody in colonial America understood Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. Let me read to you a little excerpt from Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. Thus, when the Supreme Being formed the universe and created matter out of nothing, he imposed certain principles upon that matter for which it can never depart and without which it would cease to be. If we farther advance from mere inactive matter to vegetable life and animal life, we shall find them still governed by laws more numerous but equally fixed and invariable. Man, considered as a creature, must necessarily be subject to the laws of his creator, for he is an entirely dependent being. What he's saying is God has established principles. You find those principles, number one, in nature, and number two, you find those principles in the Bible. The function of a law is to cooperate with those fixed principles. Blackstone says, no human law should be suffered to contradict the laws of nature and the laws of revelation. So you take a look at this quote here by Blackstone, and you'll notice at the bottom, he says, no human law should be suffered to contradict the laws of nature and the laws of revelation. This is what American law used to be based on. You tried to find out as a lawyer, if you were a good one, what God has said in his word and in creation, and then you come up with a law that cooperates with the laws of God. This is why homosexuality used to be illegal in the United States of America. It was called a crime against nature. And they developed that legal perspective because they were looking at nature and they were looking at the scripture and they were saying law must harmonize with what God has said. But you see, if everything is evolving upward, you don't have fixed principles anymore. So what began to be discarded was Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law, to the point where your typical lawyer today has never even heard of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. In fact, the only thing Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law are good for today is to sit in a library and collect dust. And then another change that began to happen is what we call the case law method. This is a change in legal education. Here's a quote from Pat Robertson. Not endorsing everything Pat Robertson's ever said, but look at what he says here. I spent 3 years getting my law degree at Yale Law School. From the moment I enrolled, I was assigned huge leather-bound editions of legal cases to study and discuss. I read what lawyers and judges and professors and historians said about the Constitution, but never once was I assigned the task of reading the Constitution itself. And you see, we kind of laugh at that, but you see, it's a logical, natural outworking of positive law. If the function of a judge is to evolve the document upward, then what is important is not the Constitution itself, but the latest Supreme Court opinion. So that's why when you go to law school, you spend all your time studying what judges have said. You don't spend any time actually analyzing the text, because the text is sort of irrelevant, because the document is evolving. This has been assisted by what we call postmodern deconstruction, which basically says even if you wanted to get back to the founding fathers, you couldn't understand them anyway. It's too long ago. So Justice Brennan says this: it's arrogant to pretend that from our vantage point we can gauge accurately the intent of the framers by application of principles to contemporary questions. All too often, sources of potential enlightenment, such as records of the ratification debates, provide sparse or ambiguous evidence of the original intention. And apart from the problematic nature of the sources, our distance of two centuries cannot but work as a prism refracting all we perceive. What he's saying is, because the Constitution was written 200 years ago, and the Founding Fathers wrote over 200 years ago, even if we wanted to get back, we can't. Now, how does that strike you as a Bible-believing Christian? We study the Bible. We're not going back two centuries in our own culture. We're going back 2,000 years into a totally different culture. And in the Old Testament, we're going back even further. And we believe we can understand what the book says. And here they're arguing you can't even go back 200 years in the same culture, in the same language, and understand what the founding fathers originally meant. And I'm just trying to explain to us all why we have been severed from our roots. The case law method, postmodern deconstruction, huge societal impact. The greatest impact in our society that this legal, positive, evolving law has brought to us is judicial tyranny. Because you have to understand something about the judicial branch of government. In the judicial branch of government, at the federal level, you are appointed for life. So if I don't like what a particular court has said or a particular judge has said, I have no recourse against that judge through the ballot box in the next election cycle. If I don't like what my congressman has done or my senator has done, at least I can go mobilize and vote against them. You can't do that with the judiciary. The only thing you're really left with is impeachment. And since the Bill Clinton era, everybody's afraid to impeach anybody. So what you have are people routinely making decisions on our behalf that have nothing to do with the Constitution. And if we don't like what they do, we have virtually no recourse against them. I call that the definition of tyranny. We are living in a soft form of tyranny. So a famous quip used by judges is this: with 5 votes, we can do anything. Now, why 5 votes? Because you only need 5 votes for a majority opinion. And you notice how all of these decisions, the same-sex marriage decision and others we've seen recently, Hobby Lobby, are always these 5-4 decisions. And now with the death of Justice Scalia, many of those few decisions that used to go our direction, we can quickly see how they will not be going our direction at all. And if I don't like what they've done, tough tacos. You can't vote against them. This is the definition of what I would call an oligarchy. The word oligarchy comes from the Greek word oligos, which means few. And so in an oligarchical government, you're being governed by just a minority of people. Here's a quote from Thomas Jefferson warned against oligarchies. He wrote this: "You seem to consider judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions, a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so, and their power the more dangerous as they are in office for life. and are not responsible as the other functionaries are to elective control. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal. And you see, if our founding fathers could see what is happening now with the judicial branch of government, and if you put your ear to the ground, you can actually hear our founding fathers rolling over in their graves. Because they never envisioned the type of power that the judicial branch of government now has sway and influence over our society. And it all began in 1870 with a fundamental shift in the law schools, the theory of evolution becoming entrenched, and them building a legal philosophy on the theory of evolution, and we are just seeing the ripened bad fruit of it to the present day. Lino Greglia, who almost got on the United States Supreme Court as a Reagan appointee, writes this: "Judicial usurpation of legislative power has become so common and so complete that the Supreme Court has become our most powerful and important instrument of government in determining nature and power, questions related to nature and power of American life. Questions literally of life and death, abortion, capital punishment, or of public morality, control of pornography, prayer in schools, government aid to religious schools, and public safety, criminal procedure, street demonstrations are now all in the hands of judges under the guise of constitutional law. The fact that the Constitution says nothing of abortion has made no difference. The result is that the central truth of constitutional law today is that it has nothing to do with the Constitution, except that the words due process or equal protection are almost always used by judges in stating their conclusions. Constitutional law has become a fraud, a cover for a system of government by a majority vote of a 9-person committee of lawyers unelected and holding office for life." You see the massive changes that have taken place in our society because of this. Shift in authority, death of unalienable rights, discarding of the views of our founding fathers, the case law method, and even judicial tyranny itself. Do we have any illustrations of this? Yeah, lots of them. I'm only going to confine myself to two. Mentioned abortion a little earlier. You can read the Constitution till your eyeballs bleed. You will not find in the text of the Constitution mention of any right to procure an abortion. The judges in 1972, 1973, in the infamous Roe versus Wade decision, read that idea totally into the text, and in the process took away from the state governments the branch of government closest to the people, I might add, any ability to restrict a woman's right to procure an abortion, sometimes up into the 9th month of pregnancy. Where did they get this from? Well, they got it from something called the penumbras in the Constitution. Now, I was a law student and I said penumbras. What does that mean? I had to go look it up in a dictionary. You know what a penumbra is? It's a shadow. And this is literally the whole basis of Roe versus Wade. In the shadows of the Bill of Rights is a right to have an abortion. Now, if America wants to have a right to have an abortion, fine. Let's amend the document the way Article 5 says. Let's let the people have their say. Let's have a debate on this. But you see, this issue of abortion is very disturbing to me because it's an issue that came to us through the branch of government that is unelected. It was imposed on us. Now, you might have a strong view of abortion, pro or against, but my point is not to get into that. My point is simply this. We never even debated this. This was imposed on us by the branch of government that the founding fathers said was the least dangerous branch. Take, for example, the purging of the public schools of Christianity. You know, my mom tells me of a time when she was a young girl in elementary school that her teacher used to read to the class from the book of Psalms to school girls, school children. That was no issue at all. Suddenly, though, the Supreme Court looks at that and says, nope, that's unconstitutional. Even though you guys have been doing this in this country for 200 years, we as the court have determined, that we've stepped in, that that practice is no longer permissible. Well, based on what? Based on a strict wall of separation between church and state. Well, where is that found? It's in the First Amendment, they said. Have you read the First Amendment lately? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. You do not see the word strict in that doc, in that phrase. You do not see the word wall. You do not see the word separation. You do not see the word church. And you do not see the word state. And they base their ruling on a strict wall of separation between church and state. None of those words even appear in the First Amendment. No church, no state, no wall, no strictness. Other than that, I guess they're fairly close, right? And when they made that decision, this would go about 1962 to 1963, they failed to cite a single precedent. Now, what is precedent? Precedent is relying upon what prior courts have done. There's an ancient principle in the law called stare decisis. It's a Latin word that says, leave precedent settled. Leave settled law alone. And so you're supposed to argue before the Supreme Court, based on precedent, what prior courts have done. Look at what the court said when they swept Christianity out of the public schools. Finally, in Engle v. Vitale, only last year, these principles, that's their strict wall of separation between church and state, were so universally recognized that the court, without the citation of a single case, reaffirmed them. What is this? This is judge-made law. This is judges circumventing Article 5 of the Constitution and amending the document from the bench at will, independent of what the people think, independent of the people having a say or even a debate on the issue. Justice Scalia, who very sadly passed away recently, says this in one of his dissents, "What secret knowledge, one must wonder, is breathed into lawyers when they become members of this court that enables them to discern that a practice which the text of the Constitution does not clearly prescribe and which our people have regarded as constitutional for 200 years is in fact unconstitutional. Day by day, case by case, this court is busy designing a constitution for a country I do not recognize." See, what is the issue in these presidential elections? There's a lot of issues we can talk about. But if you want my opinion, the issue is judges, judges, judges. It's the president that's going to appoint all these judges that are going to be long on the bench after the president leaves office, even if he has two terms. I want to know, Mr. President, presidential hopeful, what is your philosophy on judges? Are you going to put people on the bench that are going to follow the founding fathers' intent, or are they going to follow this contemporary, evolving, living, and breathing document approach? Because that is largely going to dictate what kind of country we will find ourselves living in over the next several decades. What does the future hold? I've painted a very grim picture here, haven't I? Cheer up, it's about to get worse. What is the logical zenith of evolution? We have seen, here's a couple of evolutionists, we have seen that humanity is not simply moving in a vicious killing cycle, it's on an upward climb towards completing the governmental structure of the world. We are inspired by our great progress toward planethood. See, in evolutionary thought, it's not just from the goo to the zoo to you. It's a continuing upward ascent into world government or a world community. In other words, once you hit the height of evolution, according to evolutionary thought, you will have arrived at one world government. And if, as I've tried to argue in this presentation, that the judges are following an evolutionary trajectory, should it not stand to reason that globalism would show up in their opinions? Has it? I'm glad you asked that question. Yes, it has. I'll do this very quickly. Let me juxtapose two Supreme Court cases. The first was Bowers versus Hardwick, 1986. And this particular case dealt with an anti-sodomy statute in the state of Georgia. And, of course, the same-sex movement wanted to get that law struck down as unconstitutional. The case made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the court looked at that law in 1986, and they said, you know what, we don't agree with that law, but it's going to stand anyway. We're going to call it constitutional because there's nothing in the text of the Constitution that prevents this state law. In fact, if you go back to colonial America, every state in the Union had on their books laws outlawing homosexuality. So this law is consistent with or is in harmony with the founding fathers' viewpoint. Now, flash forward to 2003, Lawrence versus Texas. The identical set of facts came before the United States Supreme Court, this time coming from the state of Texas, not Georgia. An anti-sodomy statute came before them, and this time the court came to the opposite conclusion. And they struck that law down. Now, why is it that the 1986 court upheld the law, but the 2003 court struck down the law? The answer is a change of philosophy. The 1986 court was looking at the Constitution itself and the views of our founding fathers. The 2003 court was not doing that. You know what they were looking at? International law. The European Court of Human Rights. World community. World opinion. And you see, what has happened is, as the court has followed this evolutionary trajectory, globalism, which is the zenith of evolution, has found its way into more and more judicial opinions. And that's exactly where we're headed. And let me tell you something. If we're going to be bound by international law and not the United States Constitution, we better watch out. Because the First Amendment is not respected around the world. And while you're at it, you better grab your gun, because the Second Amendment is not respected around the world. What you find around the world are oppressive regimes that do not, many times they're Islamic, not respecting basic fundamental rights. And that's the danger that we find ourselves in. Sorry to give you such a depressing subject. The United States Constitution, can it last? We've seen the original vision of the founders. We've seen changes that began to happen around 1870 as the theory of evolution became entrenched and they built a legal philosophy upon the theory of evolution. We've seen how this issue and this issue alone has resulted in a top-to-down reshuffling of our society. I've given you a few illustrations of it through abortion and the separation of church and state rulings. And then finally, I showed you, if this trend is left unchecked, I'm showing you exactly where it's going. We are literally being dragged, kicking and screaming, into world government. And it is not the people voting for it that's pulling us in the direction of world government. It's unelected judges. So all of that to say, let's become discerning and wise at how Satan has used subterfuge to undermine this very important branch of government. And let's start holding politicians' feet to the fire and asking them what kind of judges that they're going to appoint.